Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 78 of Speaking of Mysteries. Les Klinger and I are going to interview best-selling author Philip Margolin about his next Amanda Jaffe novel, Violent Crimes, which is debuting tomorrow, February 9th. We also discuss his career as a defense attorney who has tried more than 30 murder cases, and his contribution to Anatomy of Innocence, Les Klinger and Laura Caldwell's upcoming anthology that pairs someone who was wrongfully convicted with a crime fiction author who will write the story. Here's Philip Margolin.
Well, here we are. This is the Bobbsey twins of Speaking of Mysteries, Nancy Clare and Les Klinger, talking with my old friend Phil Margolin on the eve of publishing book number 20.
Yep.
Phil, welcome to Speaking of Mysteries.
Thank you for having me on. This is fun talking to you guys.
Well, we hope you say that at the end of the podcast.
Well, if I don't like you, I will make a comment, because I was a criminal lawyer for 25 years, and I'm blunt. So if at the end of the podcast I don't like it, I'll be very blunt. But I'm hoping for the best.
Let's start with that.
Let's start with that.
Tell us how this happened. Where did you go wrong? You were a respectable criminal lawyer for a long time, and what happened?
It's a very weird story. I've heard a lot of writers say that in first grade they got a gold star on a story, and they, from that point on, the only thing they wanted to do is be a writer, and I'm the exact opposite. I was reading several books a week from elementary school, and a lot of them were mysteries, and some of my favorites were Perry Mason. And I decided very, very early on, I think I was 12 years old in seventh grade, that I was going to be a criminal defense lawyer when I grew up and do murder cases. But because I read so much, I was in awe of authors, and it never even dawned on me that I could possibly write a book, because I thought, you have to have the IQ of Einstein and, the talent of Shakespeare. So it was never literally on my horizon to write anything. The way it came about is very, my whole writing career has been very bizarre. When I was, after college, I was 2 years in the Peace Corps in West Africa, and then I went to NYU Law School, and I worked my way through my last 2 years teaching junior high in the South Bronx, so I had, no time to do anything except eat and breathe. And then my last semester in law school, a really neat thing happened, or two things, I guess. My wife graduated, and she had a job, and I was finishing up with a summer semester so I could graduate in 3 years like the regular day students. So she had a job, and I didn't have to teach that summer to make any money. And then I had a job waiting for me, clerking for the chief judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, so I just had to get D's to get out of law school. And I was never really that interested in grades anyway. So I had all this free time, and I didn't know what to do with it, so I decided to solve what was, for me, one of life's great mysteries, which is how do those guys fill up 400 pages with words? And I just couldn't figure out how anyone could write a novel. It just seemed impossible. So the plan was to spend the summer writing a novel based on my African experiences to see if I could write more than 25 pages on something. So I really had no plans to publish it, and I didn't care if it was good or not. I just wanted to see, could I actually write more than 25 pages? So the book ended up being 187 pages, but one thing you are trained to do as a lawyer is to be very objective and unemotional about your work. And reading the book objectively and emotionally, I realized it wasn't very good. So I never tried to get it published, but I loved the writing process. I just thought it was the most fun to make up, the three-dimensional worlds where everything went exactly the way, you wanted it to, unlike real life. So I dabbled around with it, and then in my 30s, I published a short story and got some self-confidence, and I decided I would try to write a serious novel based on the Peyton Allen murders, which is a very famous Oregon murder case that's quite unusual. And I'd stumbled across it when I was clerking at the Court of Appeals. So I had never had, I only had one writing course. I got a C+ in creative writing in college, and I had never met someone who wrote a book or anyone in publishing. I really didn't know what you would do with your book when it was finished. And I get a call out of the blue, and this is where things get strange. Marty Bauer, who had wrote next to me at NYU Law School, had stayed in New York, and I'd gone to Oregon, and we hadn't really seen each other in years. I think the last time we took a class together at night, my second year. And he said he and his wife wanted to come to Oregon on vacation. Could we get together? I said, great, you know, because he's a very nice guy. And I said he could stay at the house, and I'd show him around. So when I was driving him back from the airport, or from the airport back to the house, I asked him what he was doing, and it turns out he was one of the three lawyers for International Creative Management, the, at that time, biggest literary agency in the world. And I told him I was writing this novel, and I asked him, could you show it to somebody? Because I told him I had no formal training at the agency, just to let me know, you know, either say this is fabulous, keep writing, or really awful, stop. And he took it back to New York, just five chapters, and then without telling me, he sold the book. So I came back from a trial one night, and everyone's sitting around the office with champagne, and they said, your agent called. And I said, I didn't know I had an agent. So he got me an agent, and he sold the book, and, you know, so that's how I got published.
Wow.
That's the stuff of dreams.
It should happen.
And then the book ended up getting nominated for an Edgar Award, which was even weirder, because I used to read lots of mysteries, and if it said Edgar, I would always pick it up and read it. So it was really very bizarre when I got nominated. That's a weird story, too. I was at the law library working on a brief, and I called in for messages, and it said someone at Pocketbooks wanted you to call the publicity department. So I called up, and Marty Escher, who had been my editor over there, said he was going to submit the book for an Edgar. So I didn't think much about it because I assumed I wouldn't get it because, you know, it's really difficult. And the guy at publicity said, well, your editor wanted you to let you know that you've been nominated for an Edgar. So I said, oh, that's nice. And I hung up, and then I thought, wait a minute. Did that mean I was a finalist or that he just sent my book in? So I called him right back, and they said, well, we don't know. Well, we got to talk to your editor and call us in the morning. And when I called in the morning, they said, you're one of the five finalists. So that was really exciting.
You know, it's interesting. With the Internet these days, of course, authors are totally tuned in to all this stuff, or new authors are mostly. And you just kind of it all blithely happened to you. How exciting.
Yeah, and I still am not very Internet savvy, so probably if it was happening today, I wouldn't know anything from the Internet. So it's probably
well,
would have been the same. But having Hearthstone nominated my first book for Edgar was pretty, I mean, I was just flabbergasted.
Well, you obviously liked the process because you did it again and again and again.
Yeah, but I've had two writing careers. It's really weird. I wrote a second novel, The Last Innocent Man, that was published in 1981. So Hearthstone came out in 78, and Last Innocent Man came out in 1981. But then I stopped writing for 12 years because the same year Hearthstone got published, I argued at the U.S. Supreme Court, and my daughter was born, so it's a good trifecta. And then in between the two books, I started doing these major murder cases and big appeals. So all the stuff I wanted to do when I was a kid, I started actually doing in real life. So I just put the writing on the back burner for 12 years.
Hey, you conquered the writing world. You'd already conquered the writing world. Who needed any more, right?
Well, not really, because they weren't bestsellers. I mean, I got published twice, and I thought they were really good books. But at that point in time, it was just like a fun hobby. So it wasn't something I was super serious about. And I was very, very serious about representing people in criminal cases.
So, I mean, you've been typecast, I guess, over the years as being an author of legal thrillers. But that's not all you've written. You've gotten out of your comfort zone a few times.
Well, the book I'm really the most excited about was a side project. I wrote a book called Worthy Brown's Daughter, and it took me 30 years to write it. I started working on that book in 1983 during that 12-year period when I wasn't writing. And I just came across it in Oregon Historical Society has a journal, and I think there was an article about Holmes v. Ford in 1853, Oregon Territorial Court case that determined that you could not have slaves in Oregon. And it was a very heartbreaking case because Nathaniel Ford, who was a very powerful man in Missouri and owned lots of slaves and property, lost a lot of his wealth when the Missouri economy went belly up. So he did what people did in those days. If you failed at one part of the U.S., you picked up and moved someplace else and start over. And in Oregon, if you moved to Oregon, you could get a square mile of land for free if you, you know, agreed to farm it. So he had this family of slaves he owned, the Holmeses. Robin and Polly were the husband and wife. And they had several children. He said, look, I'm going to Oregon. If you come with me and help me set up the farm, I'll free you and your family. But if you stay here, if you don't come, I'll sell you. So he'd already sold some of their kids, and so they knew he wasn't kidding around. So they got on the wagon train with him, helped him set up the farm, and then he told them that he was going to free the mother and father but keep the kids, because when they were little, he, you know, fed them and clothed them, and he hadn't gotten any use out of them. So now they were older and could work on the farm. He wanted them to work off what they owed him. So Robin and Polly wanted to get their kids back, obviously, especially when one of them died in Holmes' custody. And I think that the death was the motivating factor for them really starting to do something. But they were black. If you were a slave in Missouri, it was illegal to be educated. So they were illiterate, and they were uneducated. That didn't mean they were stupid, but they just, you know, that was the intent of the slavery. They wanted to keep everyone uneducated so they couldn't organize. They had to get a white lawyer to help them get their kids back, and for some reason that's lost to history. Reuben Boise, who became an Oregon Supreme Court justice and was the prosecuting attorney in the territory, agreed to help them. His name's on all the paperwork. And they sued, but the problem was that Oregon was very small back then, population-wise. It was a very big area-wise, but small population-wise. And Ford had become a very powerful person in the territory. He was supposed to be the first Oregon judge and turned it down, but he was in the legislature, and no one wanted to cross him. And the way they won was just by good fortune. Since we were a territory, the President of the United States, Franklin Pierce, appointed the governor and the judges. And he nominated a guy named George Williams, who was a New Yorker and never set foot in Oregon, didn't know anything about it. And he was appointed as the Chief Justice. So when he got to Oregon, within a week, he said, I looked at the statutes and the Constitution. You can't have slaves, and he made them give the kids back. But like I said, one of them had already died in Ford's custody. So I thought it was really a heartbreaking story, and decided that I really wanted to write a novel based on it. But I had only had one history course, and it wasn't Oregon 1860 history. And so I had spent 6 years in the Oregon Historical Society Library researching it. And then off and on, I would write it. And finally, in 2014, I was really thrilled, the book came out. And I think it came out really, really well. But it was a real project, and it's sort of my labor of love.
Are all of your stories based on real cases? Just making stuff up?
No, two of them are. Heartstone, my first novel, was a heavily fictionalized version the Peyton Allen murders, and my fifth novel, The Burning Man, is a very, very heavily fictionalized version of a murder case I handled in Eastern Oregon in the mid-80s. I did 30 homicide cases, so, but most hot real-life homicide cases are pretty dull. I mean, they're not dull for the lawyer because there's all these legal issues and motions to press and, you know, you're organizing the case. And but they, you know, books have to have love interest and you have to have a lot of different suspects. And in the you know, usual murder case, guy goes into a bar and he's drunk and he gets into a fight over his favorite football team and stabs a guy. And there's 400 witnesses and he feels bad after he sobers up and confesses. So it's tough to make a really edge of your seat thrill out of something like that. So most of the plots come from my sick imagination.
Okay.
Well, that brings us to, I wanted to ask Ben, where did Amanda Jaffe come from, who is in your most recent novel?
Yeah, that's the Violent Crimes is my fifth Amanda Jaffe. And for years, I resisted doing a series. And Sherlock Holmes actually comes into play here. My third book.
I need this book for my collection?
No, he's not mentioned in it. But that's you'll hear this, what happened with the. I was motivated by something that happened with Arthur Conan Doyle. So what happens is, but you can buy all my books, Les.
Okay,
I won't protest.
You.
So what happened is, Gone But Not Forgotten, my third book, was a huge international bestseller. I mean, anything you dream about happening when you start writing novels pretty much happened to me with that book. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 10 weeks, got up to number 3, sold well over a million copies, was the main selection of book clubs, and made into a movie, et cetera, et cetera. So it was so successful that when I was thinking about what my next book should be, my first thought was do an Amanda, Betsy Tannenbaum. She's the heroine of Gone But Not Forgotten. Another Betsy Tannenbaum serial killer book. And then I started thinking, well, what if it was twice as successful as Gone But Not Forgotten? Then I would be stuck writing Betsy Tannenbaum serial killer books for the rest of my life. And I remembered Arthur Conan Doyle hated Sherlock Holmes. And he tried to kill him. He threw him off Reichenbach Falls. And the public, if he wrote something that wasn't Sherlock Holmes, they wouldn't read it. And then they'd say, when's the next Sherlock coming out? So I did what I thought was sort of a gutsy move. I called up my editor at Doubleday. And I said, look, I said, I've got an idea for a new book, but it's not a Betsy Tannenbaum. I don't want to do a series right now. I have this other book. And he said, great. He said, we don't want a series. We want Gone to be an event. And if it's just the first book in a series, it won't be an event. So I was really relieved, and it was really great to have that kind of support. So what I was doing over the years is to take the genre, which, like, if you said, what are your books about? Well, every one of my books has a lawyer and a murder. But I try to do something 100% different in each book. My books never repeat, and that's intentional because I get bored. I don't want people, you know, knowing what's going to be in the book. So, you know, Gone was a very freaky, scary serial killer book. After Dark, the one I wrote after, is got more dead bodies, more twists, and a huge surprise ending, but it's really a love story, Beauty and the Beast with lawyers. So a totally different feel to it than Gone. And then The Burning Man was a coming-of-age story with lawyers, so et cetera, et cetera. So my plan was just to write these. I hope that if I wrote really good books, readers would buy them, even if it wasn't a series, that they liked the books and they'd just get them. Well, my seventh book was my first book I wrote for HarperCollins, and that was Wild Justice, and that introduced Amanda and Frank Jaffe, a father-daughter criminal defense lawyer team. And it's one of my better books, and I love the characters. I just thought they were great. But it was supposed to be a standalone. I had no intention of writing another Amanda Jaffe. So then I wrote The Associate, and that has nothing to do with Amanda and Frank, but the hero gets arrested for a murder he didn't commit, and he needed a defense lawyer. And I was going to invent one, but then I said, yeah, I really liked Amanda, so I just gave her a little cameo role, and she gets to represent the guy, and she's in about, I don't know, 70 pages or so. So then I wrote Ties That Bind, and Frank and Amanda were not in the outline. You know, I spent months writing, working on these outlines, and they weren't in it, but then it dawned on me that they would be perfect for the book. And I had never written a book where I moved a character from another book forward, you know, moved their, developed what happened in their life after the other book. So I thought that would be an interesting intellectual challenge. And since they really fit in, I don't believe in, like, squeezing people into a book just to make a series. I think the book turns out to be lousy. But I figured that they would fit perfectly in this book, and it would be a real challenge to see, could I do it? So I did, and then I wrote a couple more standalones, and then I wrote Proof Positive, and I'd always wanted to write a book where Amanda and Frank had cases that appear to be totally unrelated, but then turn out to be related, and that's that book. And then did some more standalones, and then I came up with with Fugitive, and now a couple other books later, I'm doing Violent Crime. So I have five books with Amanda and Frank in it, and they're, you know, some of my favorite characters. I love working with them, and, you know, I have been able to move Amanda's life forward, and I try to write the books so they could be read without reading the other books. So if you read them in order, you get a little bit better picture of Amanda and Frank's life. But I don't like it when you read a series and you get book number five is the first one you read, and then if you haven't read the other ones, you have no idea who anyone is or what's going on. So I do write them as standalones, except that they have the same characters in, and Amanda's life, you know, moves forward in the books.
Well, I wanted to switch gears, Phil. You are one of the contributors to the anthology that Nancy and I talked about on some previous shows that I'm co-editing with Laura Caldwell, called Anatomy of Innocence. This is a collection of, I guess the way to describe it is a collection of true stories as told by wrongfully convicted individuals to writers. In your case, you were working with Bill Dillon, is that correct? Is that right?
Yeah, yes.
And do you want to talk a little bit about your experience and what it was like and why you were interested in doing the project?
Well, you know, it's sort of, I don't know what it's like for the other writers in this thing, but this was sort of old hat for me. As I mentioned, I handled 30 homicide cases. And I'm frequently asked, you know, because if I get interviewed about being a writer and then they find out I was a lawyer, you know, what your most interesting cases were. And if I had to rank my cases in order of importance, the two I would put at the very top were cases involving criminal defendants that I was hired to represent them after they had been convicted and sentenced to life in prison for murder. So I was hired to handle the appeal. And when you do the appeal, whether the person did or not, it's totally irrelevant. You're just focusing on whether or not there was a legal mistake made during the trial that could have affected the verdict. And so you're asking the appellate court to send the case back for a new trial because the first trial was flawed. And you really don't care whether the guy did or not. It's really just intellectual exercise. But what happened was, in these two cases, as I was looking at the legal issues, you always have to read the transcript to find out what the facts were, what happened during the trial. And it became abundantly clear that both of these guys were totally innocent. That neither one of them had any connection whatsoever with the murder. And, you know, contrary to what everyone thinks, oh, that must have been great. Well, it's horrible, because the worst thing for a criminal defense lawyer to have is an innocent client. I know this is totally different from TV, but, you know, if you're representing someone, they did it, you know, you give them the very best defense you can. And I've represented a lot of guys who were guilty, and I've gotten acquittals for them or gotten their case dismissed. But if you lose those cases, since you know that the guy actually did what he's charged with, you don't feel so bad. But when you get an innocent client, it's horrible, because you can't screw up. I mean, the pressure is enormous. And it took me 4 years in each one of my cases to get the guy out of prison and then clear their names. So both the guys, when I finished representing, they were out on the street again without any charges against them. So I have a real personal experience with how horrible it is to be an innocent person and be sentenced to prison for something you didn't do. I think that's like the worst thing in the world. So working with Bill, his case was hideous. I mean, he should never have spent a second in jail. It was just an absolute travesty. They use that word, a travesty of justice, and that in Bill's case is an understatement. And his case was just awful. And you know, it was fascinating for me to work with him, because he got himself out. He figured out a way to get himself out of prison after serving over 20 years. So he was the guy that did it. He didn't have a lawyer getting him out. He did it himself. But the fact that he had to spend about a quarter of a century in prison for something that he had no connection with whatsoever. And, you know, when the dust settled, when all the investigation was over, it was abundantly clear that he do it, but he didn't have anything to do with it. And it was, you know, the authorities acted despicably, quite frankly, in prosecuting him. So, when you asked me to do this, I had a real emotional and personal interest in writing a chapter because of my own experiences in this area.
Good. And it shows. I guess readers are going to have to wait till next spring to read the book. It's going to come out in February of 17, but it is powerful, powerful material from brilliant writers like Phil Martelin with heart-wrenching stories. So look forward. It's called Anatomy of Innocence, edited by Laura Caldwell and me.
And it's a great project, because I think the money goes to the Innocence Project in Chicago,
It goes to the Life After Innocence Project in Chicago, which is a project that works with exonerees to help them sort of get back on their feet, reenter society.
Yeah, which is something people don't realize. So you say, oh, this is great. You got an innocent guy out of prison. You know, here's a pat on the back, and we're really glad for the guy. But then what do you do after? Like with Bill, spent a quarter of a century in jail. I mean, and jail's a very weird environment.
Right.
It does not prepare you for life in the real world.
Well, Phil, it's been great having you on the show. And we'll be back. Good luck with this book. And we'll be back for your next book, Brad. So
thank you. I'm about 200 pages into the next one. So I always keep writing. I love writing.
Great.
Well, thanks again for joining us, and hopefully we'll get you back either for the next book or to talk about the Innocence Project.
Either one, I'd love to do it. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, good.
Great.
So that's your blunt review. Thank you.
That's it. That's my lawyer review.
Later today, I'll be publishing the interview I did with Barry Lancet, who will talk about his third Jim Brody mystery, Pacific Burn, which is due for publication also tomorrow, February 9th. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.